I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Coming up, another teen suicide after bullying. But first, that Nigerian man accused in the Christmas Day airline bomb attack, awaiting a civilian trial, has now reportedly turned against the former American-born Yemeni cleric who was his teacher and is also spilling the beans about al-Qaeda in Yemen. Umar Farouk Abdulmutallab's family was flown from Nigeria to see their son last week. He's been cooperating with the FBI ever since, reportedly helping them in the hunt for cleric Anwar al-Awlaki. You can link to our story about al-Awlaki at our website, hereandnow.org. But meanwhile, the Christmas plane suspect's cooperation comes in the middle of a fierce debate over accused terrorists. Should they be tried in civilian courts, as Abdulmutallab is, or in military tribunals? Republicans are saying the administration is leaking information about Abdulmutallab's cooperation in order to advance their claim that civilian trials are best. And they vigorously protested the plan to try the alleged 9/11 mastermind in a civilian trial. Originally, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and four other defendants were to be tried in a federal court near Ground Zero, but now the Justice Department is considering new venues, and among them, a small community 60 miles to the north of Ground Zero. The BBC's Matthew Wells has their story.
The city of Newburgh, population just 28,000, is no stranger to major events in American history. George Washington had his headquarters during the Revolutionary War, right where I'm standing now. But the place has fallen on very hard times. There's block after block of vacant lots and derelict buildings, and the mayor says it's time to put Newburgh back at the centre of things again, as home to America's trial of the century.
We have in there holding cells that are state-of-the-art. I mean, every single security measure you can imagine. For the judges, they come in.
Mayor Nick Valentine proudly points out the newly finished courthouse, complete with classical columns, right across the street from his family tailors. While most politicians in the state have been running the other way, he says Newburgh would embrace the trials. At first, he says, locals were skeptical of his offer to the White House.
But now a lot of people, it's settling in, and it's like, you know, although I thought you were a little crazy when you first said it, now we're looking at the fact that this thing could achieve a change in Newburgh in both security and in its financial situation. I'm the mayor of a small town, and that's it. But someone who believes in the character of the city that I represent.
So, I mean, some of these political heavyweights aren't just being guilty of a little bit of spinelessness then.
Well, I'll leave that to other people to decide. I have to work with all of them.
Well, I've just driven a few miles and I've arrived at the headquarters of the local county government. The chief executive here, Edward Diana, has a very different take on the terror trials from the mayor.
We're dealing with bad people here. We're dealing with people that want to hurt Americans. They've done it in the past. We also have 44 residents of Orange County that lost their lives on that most horrific day on September 11th. So we have some deep feelings in this county about not wanting them here. And I will do everything in my power. If I have to close roads, I'll close roads. If I have to sue the federal government, I'll sue the federal government.
Passions are running high on both sides of the debate, even here at Newburgh's most genteel lunch spot, Cafe Macchiato. Small business owners Patrick and Karen see the trials as a magnet for new investment of all kinds.
I guess from an economic standpoint, I think anything that puts Newburgh on the map.
Yeah, no, I think it would probably be very helpful to the local economy.
Lots of lawyers lunching.
Exactly. Yeah, and reporters.
But other locals lunching across the room said the mayor was failing to think through the consequences of a harrowing event that could last years.
I think it's too dangerous.
So you don't buy the economic argument the mayor's putting?
No, I don't. I don't think a small city is the proper place to address something as grand as this.
We don't have the infrastructure to handle it, so it's the not in my backyard syndrome. Nobody's going to want it in their backyard.
Assuming that the terror trials go ahead in a civilian court, as the White House insists, it's hard to imagine any community being entirely happy to host them. But Newburgh has little to lose, and the thousands of new inhabitants, during daylight hours at least, would bring in desperately needed income. It'll take more than an historic trial, though, to lift these rundown streets out of a recession with no end in sight.
That's the BBC's Matthew Wells reporting from Newburgh, New York. Now to school bullying. We've spoken here before about the stunning number of kids who commit suicide after being bullied. A girl in Missouri who was actually bullied by a mother pretending to be a kid on MySpace. Four young boys across the country almost in the same week last year. And recently, a beautiful teenager, Phoebe Prince, of South Hadley in western Massachusetts. The 15-year-old new student from Ireland committed suicide last month after alleged relentless bullying by a group of girls, and despite the fact that last fall the school district hired a bullying specialist to counsel the school. Well, now South Hadley parents are demanding that Superintendent Gus Sayer step down. He says school officials did all they could.
There was one incident that did occur about a week before her death, which was acted on very promptly by the principal, and he took appropriate action with the students involved in that incident. It was only subsequent to that that bullying was intensified, and it just was not reported to us.
There is also now pressure on the state legislature to pass an anti-bullying bill that would force schools to report instances of bullying along with official response to them. Barbara Coloroso is the author of a number of books, including The Bully, The Bullying, and The Bystander. She was the counselor invited by South Hadley school officials before Phoebe Prince's suicide. She says the school didn't really take her advice. Today we want to find out for schools across the country, what is that advice? Barbara joins us from Littleton, Colorado. And Barbara, just to review, the principal of South Hadley High, Daniel Smith, we heard from him, also wrote a letter to parents after Phoebe's death saying what we just heard. School personnel did intervene. They provided counseling and discipline for the bullies. But you said it, that doesn't matter if that isn't made public. And you also say the targets have to have a safe haven. Explain.
I'm going back to the original reporting of an incident that was caught in the school by a teacher. It was actually seen. And the girl there was actually disciplined, but it didn't stop. So the discipline procedure failed to keep the target safe. More importantly, kids need to see that these kids who did these things have to be held accountable. After Phoebe died, when they show back up in school and are mocking her death and defacing her Facebook memorial page, the other kids are saying, look, these kids can come back to school with absolute impunity. I went in and talked to the kids afterwards, and they had two big concerns. One, that those who have been targeted and are continuing to be targeted be heard and feel safe. And two, that they see that something is being done to hold these young people accountable who targeted Phoebe so horribly.
This is a tough thing to do. I mean, bullying's been around forever. But as we well know, it's very different if you just have to navigate your way down a hall to your locker, and once you get home, you're safe. But in this new world of cyberbullying, you're not safe at all. You open your computer, you open your cell phone, and these attacks can come through those sources as well.
Yes, it's 24/7 for some children. Years ago, we could go home and shut the door. But we've got to look at all three characters here, the bully, the bullied, and the bystanders. There are no innocent bystanders. If a child gets an email that has an ugly rumor about another child, and they send that rumor on to others, they are part of the problem.
So what would you say should be done to those kids? I mean, let's get to the clearer delineation here. Is this just staying after school, or is there something criminal?
Oh, no. Oh, no. I recommend restorative justice. And legally, you can only hold the first three characters on this bully circle accountable. That's the actual perpetrator, the bully. The bully's henchmen, anyone who helped do it, and the active supporters, those kids who actually cheered them on and encouraged them. The others, though, I'd like to hold ethically responsible. Did you partake in any way? Do you laugh at it? Do you turn a blind eye? Or are you really afraid to step in? And how can you stand up and speak out and feel safe?
Well, and so let's, you know, try to be even more clear. Let's say two girls are fighting over a guy. That's a conflict, and
yeah,
maybe they can be pulled aside and helped through that. This is a group of girls literally attacking another girl with slurs. But again, what should happen to them? You write, for instance, that there is a chance that these girls committed a federal hate crime if they use certain kinds of slurs.
It is a short walk from schoolyard bullying to a hate crime because they both are about contempt for another human being. I make you an it, whether it's a racial slur, an ethnic slur, a national origin slur, your physical ability, your mental ability. Those are what's covered in the hate crime legislation. They're also covered in the elements of bullying. I make you out to be this it, I call it. That's why verbal bullying is so deadly.
So, for instance, in this case of Phoebe Prince, we know that her bulliers called her an Irish slut, and that was written online. You say that has the characteristics of a federal hate crime because it's ethnic and sexual.
Yes. First of all, it fits in the category for any bullying, so that's step one. Then there are chances for it to be a civil violation of her rights. Then if there has been force used or the threat of force, it can reach the level of a hate crime. But that's up for a judge and jury. But my part of the school in saying that is, look, folks, you have got to stop it here. And even though it's going on, perhaps this will go on, for criminal charges or even civil rights violations, you have to recognize that it has the characteristics right here of bullying.
And you're saying it's not just the bullier, it's not just the people who might have helped write the attacks on Facebook so they have a, you know, physical participation. It's not just the kids who might have, you know, cheered them on, egged them on. But if somebody's just walking down the hall and somebody shows them the text, you think that they are as responsible?
Oh, not as responsible. They're a part of the problem.
Part of the problem.
I'm glad you clarified that. Yeah. There's a bully circle, and they surround the target, make the target feel like they're no good, they're isolated, I have no friends. And this bully circle, if we're going to ever break the cycle of violence, we have to let kids know that if you are doing any of these roles, you are part of the problem.
Elizabeth Englander, a professor of psychology at Bridgewater State College, she runs something called MARC, the Massachusetts Aggression Reduction Center.
Oh, yeah.
She says that parents are the untapped source. It's parents who have to help stop this.
Well, you have to be taught to hate, and it often starts in the home. So if we're going to break this cycle, can we, in the home, help to teach our kids how to use technology in a way that is deeply caring, that helps us relate to other people in a healthy way? Or look yourself. How do you treat hired help? How do you deal with a bigoted relative at a family gathering who makes a racist comment or tells a bigoted joke? Can your children right there hear you saying, I'm bothered by that, or that was mean, that was cruel?
That becomes particularly important because Professor Englander adds that legally schools can't discipline a child for off-campus speech. That means online speech. And so it's up to the parents at that point to be online and check out and see what their kids are doing. And the Boston Globe is also reporting that parents in South Hadley say they're still removing menacing Facebook posts from the alleged bullies of Phoebe Prince. They're still doing it.
Yes, and you see, people would be stunned and say, don't they have any remorse? Remember, bullying is about contempt for another human being. And that's like a situation several years ago where two young men thought they could beat up Matthew Shepard, time to offense, leave him to die. And then when they were arrested, say, yeah, but he was gay. Or Renee Virk's murderers, when they broke her arms before they drowned her. Classmates cheered those girls on.
Well, and that horrible case took place in Canada in 97. We have to take a break. We'll be back with bullying expert Barbara Coloroso in 1 minute, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We're speaking with Barbara Coloroso about bullying. Thanks to the Internet, it's now 24/7. And last month here in Massachusetts, 15-year-old Phoebe Prince took her life after alleged bullying by mostly female students. Barbara, before the break, you mentioned that horrible case in Canada where bullying escalated to the point where a girl's arms were broken and she was drowned. That seems so obviously criminal. But I want to pick up on something you said earlier. You said you think bulliers should have restorative justice. What does that mean? Should kids who send texts or spread gossip, should they be jailed?
I'm not a real strong advocate of jailing juveniles. I prefer to hold them highly accountable and get them busy reforming. I'll give you an example very similar to Phoebe's. Dawn Marie Wesley hung herself 10 years ago at 14, left a suicide note naming the three girls who had only verbally tormented her every single day. The two tools they used was a cell phone and the Internet. The last thing texted to her was a message from one of those girls, you'd be better off dead. Now, first time in North America that three girls were arrested for contributing to the death or suicide. One girl went to jail, and the other girl opted for what Dawn Marie's mother asked, and that's restorative justice process. And I got to witness that, and I got to tell you, it is not an easy thing. And I would say the girl that came out on top was the girl who went through restorative justice. The girl who went through jail came out like, okay, I've done my time. And so I think we have to take, as a community, take a serious look. And it begins, before it reaches the point of suicide, it begins in the school with we as adults holding those kids accountable.
So you've been talking about parents whose kids are the bulliers. What if your child is the bullied? What can you do? Because they probably already feel like they're under enough attack. They don't want to draw any more attention.
The first thing we have, whether we're an educator or a parent, is I hear you. I'm here for you. I believe you. You're not in this alone. Can we hear these kids in their pain, whether they're saying it to us, by their body language, by their stomach aches, but not on holidays, all those signs. The second thing you want to say to a targeted kid, it's not your fault. Your kid may be weird, dorky, odd, have ADHD or Asperger's, both of whom miss social cues, but I want a kid to know it's not your fault that those kids are mean and cruel to you.
Well, Phoebe Prince was gorgeous.
And bright.
Gorgeous and bright and likable.
Yeah. Yes. And can you imagine now a child in that school seeing what Phoebe did, and if they don't see those other kids getting a consequence for that, for them to say, you know what, she was bright, beautiful, smart, I'm heavy, or I'm too skinny, or I'm not talented, or I'm slow, why should I stick around? So we need to say it's not your fault. There are things you can do. I really do work with empowering a kid who is more likely to succumb to bullying by giving him some good lines to say, by helping him stand tall, their shoulders back, even in their posture, they can do things. Also, who can you talk to? If somebody's targeting you, they often do it under the radar of adults, and we really don't see it. But once you alert me to it, I'll watch like a hawk and I'll catch the kid. And I will.
I'm thinking of South Hadley High, and, you know, the kids were disciplined apparently at one point and didn't stop. It just feels like I can see kids saying, yeah, right.
Yeah, exactly. It did not stop, and that's a failure on our part.
That's Barbara Coloroso, a nationally recognized expert on bullying, author of The Bully, The Bullying, and The Bystander. And we just have to ask you, Barbara, we know you're speaking to us from Littleton, Colorado. That's, of course, the home of Columbine, the school. And one of the first students killed in Columbine was a young woman named Rachel Joy Scott. And her parents actually developed an anti-bullying campaign. We know of one school here in the Boston area that uses it, and it just sort of has a, you know, no bullying allowed policy. Just your thoughts on that.
Actually, it's Rachel's brother who goes all over. I have tremendous regard for him because he doesn't want revenge. He wants results now. He wants to stop so nobody else goes through what his family has had to go through. And he does have a very strong message. It's powerful when kids hear him, for him to say, the way we're going to stop this is for each one of you to treat the other person with dignity and regard. You don't have to like every kid in the classroom, but you must honor their humanity.
Barbara, thanks so much for talking to us today.
Thank you for having me on this very important subject. We ignore it, I believe, at our kids' peril.
Well, as we said, Rachel's Challenge was started by the family of Rachel Joy Scott, who was killed at Columbine. Here is her brother, Craig, who now travels across the country speaking to students about his sister.
Today I want to share with you a story about a teenager that never did anything big in her life. She wasn't a big movie actress or a leader of a company or an organization. She was just a teenager that believed in one word really strongly, and that word was compassion.
We visited one school, the John Wynn Middle School in Tewksbury, Massachusetts, to see if Craig's message got across.
I cried. I definitely
tried to hold
cried.
Back the tears. Got a little bit.
We've had it here two times where the speakers have came and talked to us about Rachel's Challenge, and I definitely could see a difference. People were already, like, they were, you know, saying sorry to people, and they were, everyone, like, right off the bat, walking out of the auditorium had such a different look on, like, other people and how they treat other people, and they were just, you could see such a difference in the school and in the environment.
The people getting picked on, that's definitely less. I can see that now.
Yeah, I saw a difference, too. Once in a while, I would get picked on, and it's so much easier, and you don't have to worry about it, and you just come to school and do what you're meant to do. I mean, you're going to have those kids that are always going to be the bullies, but there's a big difference in how many kids were doing it.
And so I've seen, like, people trying to change themselves and change the ways about this, too.
That presentation really, really did, I think, change me, like, so much. Like, I really do think about, like, myself now as a different person. Like, just think about myself and my life, and then I think of others' lives, and it really, it gets you thinking. That presentation definitely got us thinking about a lot of things. It definitely, it was a lot of help. It was cool. I'm glad it came.
Students at the John Wynn Middle School in Tewksbury, Massachusetts, commenting on the anti-bullying program Rachel's Challenge. Well, we'd love to hear what you think. You can always go to our website, herenow.org, and click on Contact Us to send an email. You can always scroll down and leave a comment right there. We'd love to hear from you, herenow.org. Still to come today, the man who created the NFL draft and Sunday football. But the latest news is next, Here and Now. Former Colorado Congressman Tom Tancredo kicked off what organizers are calling the first Tea Party convention with a bang last night. The conservative firebrand told the several hundred anti-Washington activists gathered in Nashville that American culture is under attack, the Tea Party is a counter-revolution, and he thanked God that John McCain lost the election because the Tea Party movement wouldn't have come into existence if Obama hadn't won. But as we've been reporting, other Tea Party activists say the convention is hijacking their movement. Let's check in. Joining us from the Opryland Hotel and Convention Center in Nashville is Susan Davis, who's the lead writer for the Wall Street Journal's Washington Wire column. Sue, what's the atmosphere there that you're seeing? What's jumped out at you?
I think what you're seeing here, it's a very enthusiastic crowd. One of the things that you notice about these Tea Party organizations and when groups get together, either at the rallies or the marches, is they're really interested in getting to know one another. It's highly social. I think that they use these opportunities to sort of self-organize. So you see a lot of people meeting, talking, exchanging emails, figuring out who runs what website and how they can keep in touch after this event.
Well, and this is one of the criticisms of some of the people not attending. They say there shouldn't be a hierarchical organization, at least. There's no national leader. They're also criticizing the event itself because it's for-profit. Tea Party Nation, Inc. is a for-profit group. It was put together by a Republican attorney, Judson Phillips, and his wife, you know, very much grassroots. But now critics are saying, you know, they're seeing it as a money-making venture.
That's right. I just spoke to Judson Phillips within the past hour, and I asked him about that. And I said, you know, how do you respond to critics? And if you had to do this again, would you do it again as a for-profit corporation? And he said, absolutely. He said he has no regrets about the way he's organized it. He noted that he has not personally profited from this, but that he felt that it was a more honest way to do it, and because of, in the heart of a lot of this movement, one of the lines you hear people say is that they embrace capitalism and they believe in the free market. So he said that he thinks it's more of an honest way to do it, to run it as a for-profit corporation, and if they do it again, he'll do it the same way.
Well, what about Tom Tancredo's fiery speech, you know, thanking God that John McCain lost? We hear that some Tea Partiers are a little upset at that analogy, too, because they're not about any specific candidate. They're about being against government, big government.
That's right. I think some of the bigger lines that got a lot of applause from that in Tancredo's speech is one of the things, it's hard to say what unites them, because there's not really one cohesive idea as to what this is. It's really a group that I would say is rooted in fiscal conservatism, and then when you break off into social or defense or immigration issues, there starts to be a greater amount of disagreement. The lines that Mr. Tancredo said that got the greatest amount of applause is when he talks about American exceptionalism. One of the things that really seems to get the people here fired up is an unapologetic view that America is the best country in the world and needs to remain that way, and that the American culture and the American way is the right way. So when he says comments, you know, that we should not apologize for this country and we should embrace everything about it, that is what gets them fired up. It's very much a movement, I would say, that right now hasn't yet moved beyond slogans.
Well, Susan Davis, you know, some people would say that actually they know what it is and what it's become anyway. It's become a Republican Party organization, and this is another criticism from Tea Partiers, that while it might have started as grassroots, it's become AstroTurf. Groups like the Tea Party Express or Freedom Works, these are GOP activists. And part of the national organizing strategy that's expected to be announced today by the organizers is to say that candidates will be expected to support the Republican National Committee platform. So in just the minute we have, are you hearing from people in a way, hey, wait a minute, we weren't ever supposed to be just an extension of one party?
Yes, I do think they're saying that, but at the same time, they're also saying that they don't want to become a third party. That there's an overwhelming, I've talked to no one who thinks that this is the right time to create a third party, that they would rather work within the confines of the two-party system to affect the kind of change they're talking about. And because of their issue areas tend to line up more within the Republican Party, I think there's an acknowledgement that if you're going to change the system, you're going to have to align with the Republican Party in some way.
Susan Davis, lead writer for the Wall Street Journal's Washington Wire column at the Tea Party Convention in Nashville, Tennessee. Susan, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
We're going to take a quick break, just 30 seconds, and come back with the legacy of Burt Bell. You may not have heard his name, but you've certainly watched his game. It's football. Back in 30 seconds, here and now. Welcome back. On Sunday in Miami, the New Orleans Saints take on the Indianapolis Colts in Super Bowl 44. More than 100 million people will watch around the world, not just the game, but the halftime show. Previous performers, Paul McCartney, The Stones, this year, The Who. By the way, what's up with that? They don't even play this kind of football in England. Well, then there's the ads, with slots selling for $3 million a pop this year.
Highlight!
Super Bowl Sunday. It's a cultural phenomenon, and in a way, we owe it all to one man, Burt Bell. There's a chance you're saying, who? But Burt Bell was an owner of the Philadelphia Eagles and the Pittsburgh Steelers, and from 1946 until his death in 1959, commissioner of the National Football League, taking the game from a sport that couldn't even be played on Sunday at one time into an American juggernaut. His story is told in the new book, On Any Given Sunday, A Life of Burt Bell by Robert Lyons. And here to tell the story to us, Burt's son, Upton Bell, well-known radio host currently of the Upton Bell Show on WCRN in New England. But as we're going to hear, he has his roots in Philadelphia's main line. Uppy, welcome.
Great to be on with you, Robin.
Boy, what a story. Your dad, born into privilege on Philadelphia's main line, wore a suit to breakfast with his dad, your grandfather. But then, wait a minute, bets his roadster on a football game and loses it. Give us the thumbnail. Who was your dad?
He was really kind of an American original. I mean, here's a guy that started at the top and purposely tried to work his way down in society to overcome the kind of that rich kid image. In fact, he actually one time went down to Philadelphia Records Bureau and tried to change his name from DeBeneville Bell to Burt Bell, which is the name that he's always been known by.
Right. Well, he had a nanny at the age of two, a pony at six, a tux at 12, that Marmon Roadster at 17. His father was a star football player at the University of Pennsylvania who went on to become Attorney General of Pennsylvania and said of his son, he's going to go to Penn or go to hell. And your dad, his son, Burt Bell, did go to Penn and raised hell, I guess, is one way to put it. Tell us what he was like in school.
Well, actually, he hardly went to class. He had a guy that he hired to actually go to class and answer for him. But one of the interesting quick stories about him is, think of Tim Tebow, who won the Heisman Trophy 2 years ago.
Sure.
Think about his junior year going to the football coach and saying, you know what, I really care about my country, so I'm going to volunteer to fight in the First World War, which is what he did. He left to actually go overseas and fight, and got a medal from General Pershing and the President of France.
Yeah, he also made a best friend for life, John Kelly, an Olympic rower, and served with your dad. That's how you got to know John Kelly's daughter, Grace Kelly. You guys grew up together there in Philadelphia. Your dad comes back from the war, and I'm going to jump ahead in the story because obviously he loves football. But before he could really go as far as he did in football, he had to meet your mother. Tell us about your mom, Frances Upton, an actress quite famous. She would not marry him until he gave up his ways, and he did on a dime.
She was in Chicago with one of the shows she was playing in with the Ziegfeld Follies, and he called her with a bunch of drunken bums and said, Frances, I love you very much. I want to marry you. And she said, again, I won't marry somebody who drinks. And he said, I've got all my friends here tonight, and I want to tell you something, Frances. I'll never have a drink the rest of my life if you'll marry me. And, of course, they did get married, and he never had a drink the rest of his life. I mean, that's really an amazing part of the story.
And the book tells of a real love story, love letters between your parents. But I just want to ask, your mom, you know, because she's, you know, on Broadway and in the Follies, she traveled in some wild circles back then. Wasn't there some encounter with mobsters or something?
Well, at that time, in show business, the mobsters owned most of the big shows. And she had dinner with Al Capone, where they lined all of the people that were in the party, my mother and her friends in the show business end of it, with their backs to the door, and with Al Capone and Machine Gun Ned McGurn and Footsie and Wingy and Frisco Legs with their backs against the wall. So my mother said to Al Capone, "Oh, Mr. Capone, isn't it so nice, but why are we sitting on one side and you're sitting on the other?" And he said to her, "Well, my dear, I just want to tell you, if somebody comes in to shoot us, you will be the people that get it first."
Great stories. Unbelievable stories. Well, it's out of this wonderful vat of stories that comes your dad, now moving on to be a team owner and ultimately NFL commissioner. In a really rough time, pro football wasn't anywhere near it is today. And some of the things that he'd been thinking as both a player and an owner of a team, he was able to start implementing. Let's jump ahead and just tick off some of the innovations that your father brought to the game that helped make it what it is today. Start with the player draft.
Well, there was no such thing in those days for any league of any type of draft, and he came up with the idea of a player draft, pushed it through in 2 or 3 days because the rich owners were against it, because in the player draft, basically, the worst teams would pick first in an inverse order all the way up to the best team. So it was going to be hard to push it through, but since he wasn't drinking and most of the other owners did drink at the time, he just stayed up all night and all day till he got it pushed through. Now, 80 years later, every league in America and in Europe uses a form of draft that Bert Bell invented.
Right. He was also the first to receive a license to play football on Sunday. There were blue laws back then. That couldn't happen. And both those things, playing on Sunday and the draft, would, by the way, come up again in 1958. We're jumping way ahead here. He's NFL commissioner at this time. He's lobbying Congress for NFL exemption from antitrust laws that threaten this player draft. And in his testimony, he's credited with coining the phrase that's now the axiom of the NFL. What's that phrase?
It's called on any given Sunday. And interestingly, you know how he got it through. He was, by the way, the only major executive in history in sports to register himself as a full-time lobbyist. So he used to go to Washington every week. Finally, he got the attention of Lyndon Johnson, and here's how the deal went. "If you promised not to subject us to antitrust," Johnson said, "I've got my daughter Lucy who could be interested in one of your boys." He said, "How about fixing up Lucy with one of the boys?" So he agreed to fix my brother up with Lucy Johnson, and of course, then they were not subject to antitrust. So, I mean, that's how things were done there.
Well, but there was also a hearing, we should say. and he your father said, "It doesn't matter in the NFL how many games you win, what your score is, how well you do. On any given Sunday, any team in the NFL can win."
That's correct, Robin.
That
and the reason that he did was that he made up the schedule and made sure that every team by the middle of the season was tied. So the weak teams and the strong teams were always in the race, which you see today, 80 years later. But the difference is he was the computer. Now they use computers.
We're talking with Upton Bell, whose father, Bert Bell, was commissioner of the National Football League from 1946 to 59 and revolutionized the game, creating the NFL draft. And in his first year as commissioner, his league broke the color line a year before Jackie Robinson integrated baseball. Then, Upton, in the 50s, when TV was on the rise, your dad came up with revenue sharing, each team getting an equal share of the profits from broadcasts. But team owners were very afraid of television. They thought people would stay home from games and watch them. So your dad came up with the so-called blackout rule.
What he did was that there were so many teams that weren't making money that he said, if you televise the home games, you will kill the gate and these teams will be out of business. There'll be no league. So he got it pushed through Congress that basically every home game by every home team would not be televised unless it was sold out. In fact, I will tell you that Richard Nixon came in 1958 and tried to persuade him to take a championship game on television and open it up, even though it wasn't sold out yet. My father told Nixon to go to hell, that basically he wasn't changing the policy because all the people that bought the tickets, they're going to be the people that are upset because the game wasn't sold out.
Right. And I just want to tick through some of the other innovations from your dad. He threatened to quit in 1957 if owners didn't accept his idea that a players' union was in the best interest of pro football. Of course, they all came around, and the NFL recognized players' unions.
For the first league that ever did it, by
right?
the way.
But we want to actually hear another of Burt Bell's innovations. It bore fruit in 1958 during a championship game between the New York Giants and the Baltimore Colts. Let's listen.
Unitas fakes to Amici, then drills a 15-yard touchdown pass to end Ray Berry.
Pro football came of age with the 1958 championship game. Millions watched as for the first time an NFL game went to overtime. Burt Bell's inspired marriage of network TV and sudden death secured the future of pro football.
On third down, four blocks and Amici rockets for the touchdown. The Colts win, the greatest game ever played.
Do you remember when you, in the book it says that just sort of like it was a light bulb going off for your dad.
I hate to use the word genius, but he was so far ahead of his time. He felt this sudden death would increase interest by people around the country because the team that got the ball and the team that scored, that was it, sudden death, and it was over. And he gave it the name sudden death, pushed it through, and that was one of the last great pieces that he put in place to make the league last. This game in 1958 was the last championship game he would ever see because he was dead 8 months later, and he died at the Franklin Field where he used to play between the two teams that he used to own in the last 2 minutes of the game.
This is the Pittsburgh Steelers and the Philadelphia Eagles.
Yep.
Well, and you were at this game in 1959.
Yep.
It's been described as like Caruso dying in the opera Pagliacci. You know, you were there. You saw, as the players did, sort of a ruckus going on. You raised your glasses. Did you know it was your dad?
I had my glasses over there, and I said, oh, my God, that's my father.
Yeah.
And I actually jumped the wall. I ran onto the field to play. In the last 2 minutes, as the Eagles dramatically were scoring on a great comeback against the Pittsburgh Steelers, his other team got up into the stands there, but, you know, he was gone.
Yeah.
That was it, but... you think of sudden death. Isn't it ironic that he named it sudden death and that's the way he would die? Sudden death.
Doing what he loved.
Yep.
That's Upton Bell, the son of Burt Bell, whose story is told in the new book, On Any Given Sunday, A Life of Burt Bell. It's by Robert Lyons. For more, you can go to our website, hereandnow.org. Upton Bell, again, a longtime radio host here in the Boston area. But you could have been, before we leave, you could have been the owner of the Philadelphia Eagles.
Well, I'd be calling you from the Eagles box and saying, Robin, how's everything here and now? And what happened is that the week that my father died, my brother came home and he said the Philadelphia National Bank called me and told me the deal's off. And my brother said, what are you talking about? They said, well, your father had agreed, signed the papers to buy the Eagles back. Forget this. This is 1959 for less than $1 million. Mm. And they said, since he died, we just can't go through with the deal. So the most important thing is we lost a father. But the other thing, it would have been nice for the Bell family tradition to go back to the team he used to own. But that's the way life is. You pay your money, Robin, and you take your chances.
Uppy, thanks so much.
Okay.
Well, going into Sunday, Super Bowl 44, one team has an advantage in at least one category, fan tribute songs. Here now, music critic Christopher Blagg has a sampling of the musical outpouring from New Orleans for the Saints.
It's prime, baby.
Take what the defense is giving you now. Don't start forcing it.
There's no better way to show pride in one's hometown team than to write them a tribute song. Most teams elicit a few amateurish salutes, but in the musical hotbed of New Orleans, more than 80 songs have been recorded to shower praise on their beloved Saints. Stylistically, they run the gamut, and you won't find any amateurs here. You've got your thumping second-line parade shuffles, like the pinstripe brass band's Them Saints on a Roll. A bevy of hip-hop tributes, including this one by Kay Gates. There's even been some hardcore heavy metal endorsements. Check out this riffage from Down. Most everything in New Orleans is tied to its cultural heritage. So we have the Mardi Gras Indian tradition paying homage to the Saints with Big Chief Howard Miller of the Creole Wild West singing, Here Come the Saints.
Here come the Saints. Here come the Saints.
Mighty Saints.
Technically, the Saints belong to the Crescent City, but other parts of the state, like fiddle-soaked Cajun country in southwest Louisiana, are rightly staking their claim of ultimate fan devotion. Give a listen to Lafayette's Bayou Boys. In fairness, Indianapolis Colts fans haven't been silent. A rap rock tribute called Blue Sunday recently hit the web.
Rex Ryan thought he had us with two early sacks. The Jets kept coming with a blitz attack. But Peyton's too smart, he was able to see. That's why he's the four-time MVP.
So has Do It Again by a hip-hop group called the Mud Kids.
Big goal, Super Bowl.
Bring the banners home.
We close the roof and tear it off of Indiana homes. You rockin' with the blue again, clued into your zone. Bring the blitz, short drop and the slant is thrown.
But the smattering of cult songs this year pales in comparison to the sheer numbers of Saints tunes pouring out of the bayou. Musically speaking, this is a blowout. Okay, sure, songs don't win Super Bowls. But when you've got two equally matched teams, a little extra mojo can't hurt. Whatever happens on Sunday, one thing is certain. Civic pride has never sounded so good.
Sisters and brothers, this is Reverend Satchmo getting ready to beat out this mellow sermon for you. My text this evening, when the Saints go marching in, here come Brother Hickenbottom down the aisle with his trombone. Blow it, boy.
So, to see the Indianapolis Colts tribute songs, it's a short but heartfelt list. And to see the entire New Orleans Saints tribute song playlist, go to our website, hereandnow.org. And former New Orleans resident Christopher Blagg produced our story.
Oh, when the Saints,
when the Saints
go marching in,
marching in.
Now, when the Saints go marching in,
marching in.
Yes, I want to be in that number when the Saints go marching in.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Robin Young. May the best team win. And please join us on Monday, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.